explains or worlds elements of the ancient Sanskrit English. Sanskrit English Atma will Akasha ether or sky body intuition veil air manas mind tejas or Agni fire karma feeling upas or jala water stula physical life prithivi earth. In certain Hindu books there is another classification, in which the mind is grouped with the elements. The Hindu has a way of looking at things from a very high standpoint, often, apparently, from that of the monad, and to him the mind is but an instrument of consciousness. Thus, in the 7th chapter of the Gita, Sri Krishna says, earth, water, fire, air, ether, manas, buddhi, and ahamkara, these are the eightfold divisions of my manifestation. Prakriti. A little later on she speaks of these eight as my lower manifestation. The mental world is the world of the real man, the very word man deriving from the Sanskrit root man, the root of the verb to think, thus man means thinker. He is named by his most characteristic attribute, intelligence. The mental world is thus the land of our birth, the realm to which in truth we belong, for our native atmosphere is that of ideas, not of physical phenomena. When man, the thinker, became incarnate in the physical vehicle built for his reception, the senseless animal became the thinking being by virtue of the manas which entered into and dwelt in him. Thus man became clothed in his coat of skin after his fall into physical matter, in order that he might eat of the tree of knowledge and thus become a god. Hence man is the link between the divine and the animal. The mental world is of peculiar interest, not only because man, after the mind is fairly developed, spends here nearly all his time, dipping down into the physical world only for brief snatches of mortal life, but also because it is the meeting ground of the higher and lower consciousness. In English, the word mind stands both for the intellectual consciousness itself, and also for the effects produced on the physical brain by that consciousness. In occultism, however, we must conceive of the intellectual consciousness as an individual entity, a being, the vibrations of whose life are thoughts, expressed not as physical words, but as images. The real man is manas, the thinker, working on the higher or causal levels of the mental plane. Only a small section of his vibrations, and even that very imperfectly, can be reproduced in the comparatively coarse physical materials, the physical brain and nervous system being able to reproduce but a small fragment of the vast series of mental vibrations set up by the thinker in his own world. Very receptive brains respond up to the point of what we call great intellectual power, exceptionally unresponsive brains respond up to the point of what we call idiocy, exceptionally responsive brains up to the point of what we call genius. The so-called mental powers of each man thus represent the degree of sensitiveness of his brain to the millions of thought waves from the thinker to which it can respond. Thus consciousness working in the brain is illuminated, from above, by ideas that are not fabricated from materials supplied by the physical world, but are reflected into it directly from the universal mind, see below. The great laws of thought regulate all thinking, and the very act of thinking reveals their pre-existence, as it is done by them and under them, and is impossible without them. Taking a still wider view of the mental plane, it may be described as that which reflects the universal mind in nature, the plane which, in our little system, corresponds with the great mind in the cosmos. This great mind is Mahat, the third logos, or divine creative intelligence, the Brahma of the Hindus, the Manjusri of the northern Buddhists, the Holy Spirit of the Christians. The universal mind is that in which all archetypically exists. It is the source of beings, the fount of fashioning energies, the treasure house in which are stored up all the archetypal forms which are brought forth and elaborated in lower kinds of matter during the evolution of the universe. These are the fruits of past universes brought over as seeds for unfoldment in the present universe. It is on the higher part of the mental plane that exist the archetypal ideas which are now in course of concrete evolution. In its lower regions these are worked out into successive forms, to be duly reproduced in the astral and physical worlds. An example of these ideas is that of the small artificial elementals, which may sometimes be seen hanging around a plant or flower, all through the time that the buds are forming. These are thought forms of the great devas who supervise the evolution of the vegetable kingdom, and are created for the special purpose of carrying out their ideas connected with the plants and flowers. Such an elemental usually takes the form of an etheric model of the flower itself, or of a little creature which gradually builds the flower into the shape and color of which the deva has thought. When the work is done, the power of the elemental is exhausted, and the matter of which it is composed dissolves into the general store of such matter. These artificial elementals must not, of course, be confused with nature spirits, see the astral body p. 181, which I frequently see in playing about flowers. Before the Manu of a chain or round commences the task appointed for him, he examines the part of that mighty thought form of the Logos which refers to his work, and brings it down to some level within easy reach for constant reference. The same thing is done at a lower level by the Manu of each world and of each root race. Each Manu then builds as nearly as he can to the model he was before him, usually approaching the perfection required by degrees, the earlier efforts at the formation of a race, for example, being often only partially successful. At the beginning of the present fourth round, all the archetypes for humanity were brought down, including those races which have not yet come into existence. From an examination of these, it is possible to see what the men of the future will be like. They will have fine vehicles in every way, and will be distinctly more beautiful in appearance, expressing in their forms the spiritual forces. It was on Globa in the fourth round that mind became definite on the lower mental level, and so we may say that it is in this round man began really to think. The result at first was by no means good. In previous rounds he had not been sufficiently developed to originate thought forms to any great extent, and so the elemental essence of the globes had been affected only by the thoughts of the devas, who left everything harmonious and peaceful. But when man began to interject his selfish and jarring thoughts, this comfortable condition was very largely disturbed. Strife, unrest and disharmony were introduced, and the animal kingdom drew decisively apart from man, and began to feel fear and hatred towards him. On Globa there were also the group souls of animals and vegetables, and even minerals. It is, of course, difficult for us to conceive what a mineral could be on the mental plane. It would correspond to our thought of a mineral, but the thought form which exists there is that of the Manu, and is molded by a power altogether beyond comparison with that of our mentality. As we saw in Chapter 2, in the natural course of events, the present fourth round should be devoted chiefly to the cultivation of the emotions. The next round, the fifth, should be that of intellectual advancement. We are, however, a long way in advance of the program marked out for us. This advance is entirely due to those august beings variously called the Lords of the Flame, the Children of the Fire Mist, the Lords of Venus, who came to this earth from the planet Venus. Most of them stayed with us only through that critical period of our history, a few still remain to hold the highest offices in the Great White Brotherhood, until the time when men of our own evolution shall be able to relieve them of their high office. As was explained in chapters 7 and 8, the materials of the mental plane are capable of combining, under the impulse of thought vibrations, and can give rise to any combination which thought can construct. Just as iron can be made into a spade or a sword, so can mental matter be shaped into thought forms to help or to injure. In this region, thought and action are thus one and the same thing. Matter is the obedient servant of life, adapting itself to every creative impulse. The mental plane, being that of thought itself, the very home of thought, is thus far nearer reality than any lower plane. For everything that is material is buried and hidden in matter, whatever of reality it may possess being far less obvious and recognizable than it would be when regarded from a higher standpoint. The whole of our solar system being a manifestation of the Logos, every particle in it is part of his vehicles. Hence all the mental matter in the system constitutes his mental body. This, of course, comprises not only the mental world belonging to each of the physical planets, but also those belonging to each of the astral planets, and in addition, the purely mental planets, usually called, in our chain of worlds, globes A and G. It may be noted, parenthetically, that the man of Globe A in the first round can hardly be called a man at all. He is a thought, he is what will someday be a mind-body, the germ of a mind-body, bearing perhaps the same relation to its later possibilities as the embryonic form of an infant after the first month bears to the fully developed human body. At this early stage, he has marvelously little consciousness. The matter described above is composing the mental body of the solar logos, also composes the mental bodies of the seven planetary logoi, which are centers of force within the solar logos. Now in every man's mental body there are particles belonging to each one of the seven planetary logoi, but the proportions vary infinitely, these proportions determining the type of each person. In the seven planetary logoi certain psychic changes periodically occur, and these changes are bound to affect the bodies of every man in the world, because the materials of his bodies are also the materials of the planetary logoi. The degree to which he will be affected will, of course, depend upon the proportion in his bodies of the type of matter appropriate to that particular logos. Hence the importance to man of the motions of these planetary spirits and the ultimate rationale of astrological science. The influences belonging to these great types affect, amongst other things, the elemental essence which, as we have seen, cp. 6, is vividly active in the astral and mental bodies of men. Hence any unusual excitement of any of these types must affect to some extent either man's emotions or his mind, or both, to a degree corresponding to the amount of the particular type of essence concerned which he possesses in his vehicles. Such influences in themselves are no more good nor evil than any other natural force. They may be helpful or hurtful according to the use we make of them. It is important to realize that any pressure these influences may bring to bear on man cannot dominate his will in the slightest degree. The most it can do is in some cases to make it easier, or more difficult, for that will to act along certain lines. A man of iron determination, or a student of occultism, may put these influences aside as a negligible quantity. For men of weaker will it may sometimes be worthwhile to know at what moment this or that force can most advantageously be applied. The wise man rules his stars, the fool obeys them, whilst each physical globe has its physical, astral and mental planes, all interpenetrating one another, and therefore occupying the same space. All of these are yet quite apart, and do not communicate with the corresponding planes of any globe. It is only at and beyond the bodhic level that there is a condition common to all the planets of our chain. Notwithstanding the above, there is a condition of the atomic matter of each of these planes which is cosmic in its extent. In fact, the seven atomic subplanes of our system, taken apart from the rest, may be said to constitute the lowest cosmic plane, sometimes called the cosmic prakritic. Thus our mental plane is the third subdivision of the lowest cosmic plane. Regarded in another way, the atomic part of our mental plane is also the lowest subplane of the mental body of the planetary logos. The astral plane of the Earth extends to a little less than the mean distance of the Moon, the Earth and the Moon being nearly 240,000 miles apart. The mental plane of the Earth, which is of course a definite globe, extends still further into space than does the astral plane, bearing about the same proportion to the astral as does the astral to the physical. Only that portion of the atomic matter of the astral and mental planes which is in an entirely free condition is coextensive with the interplanetary ether, which consists of ultimate physical atoms in their normal and uncompressed state. Consequently, a person can no more pass from planet to planet of our chain in his astral or mental body than he can in his physical body. In the causal body, when very highly developed, this achievement is possible, though not with the ease and rapidity with which it can be done at the Buddhic level. Furthermore, the detailed sight of other planets would not be possible for any system of clairvoyance connected with the mental or any lower plane, though a good deal of information could be obtained by exercising a high magnifying power, cp. 116. Matter of the lower planes is never carried over from planet to planet. When, for example, we leave this planet in order to incarnate upon Mercury, only the egos will be carried over. Those egos will draw around themselves mental and astral matter belonging to their new planet, and will obtain physical bodies provided by those who are already inhabiting Mercury. The matter of the mental plane is divided into seven grades of fineness, precisely as is that of the astral and the physical planes. For want of other terms, these must for the present be denoted by the terms given to the seven grades of physical matter, that is, solid, liquid, gaseous, etc. The highest or finest subdivision consists, of course, of ultimate mental atoms. An ultimate mental atom contains 49^4 or 5th 764^801, roughly 5¾ million, bubbles in koilon. The three higher grades of mental matter are called arupa, or formless, the four lower grades are termed rupa, or having form. The distinction is a real one, being related to the divisions on the mind itself. In the rupa levels, the vibrations of consciousness give rise to images or pictures, every thought appearing as a living shape. In the arupa levels, consciousness seems rather to send out flashes or streams of living energy, which does not body itself into distinct images, while it remains on its own levels, but which, when it rushes into the lower mental levels, sets up a variety of forms, all linked by some common condition. In other words, the arupa levels are concerned with the expression of abstract thoughts, ideas, principles, and the rupa levels with concrete thoughts and particular ideas. Words being largely symbols of images, and belonging to the workings of the lower mind in the brain, it follows that it is almost, if not quite, impossible to describe in words the workings of abstract thought. For the arupa levels pertain to the pure reason, which does not work within the narrow limits of language. Another broad distinction between the rupa and the arupa levels of the mental plane is that on the rupa levels a man lives in his own thoughts, and fully identifies himself with his personality and the life which he has recently quitted. On the arupa levels he is simply the reincarnating ego who, provided he is sufficiently developed on that level to know anything at all, understands, at least to some extent, the evolution upon which he is engaged, and the work that he has to do. Mental matter being so much finer than either astral or physical matter, it follows that the life forces on the mental plane are enormously increased in activity. Mental matter is in constant, ceaseless motion, taking form under every thrill of life and adapting itself readily to every change of motion. Even astral matter seems relatively heavy and lusterless. The vibrations of mental matter are as much more rapid than physical vibrations as vibrations of light are more rapid than physical vibrations as vibrations of light are more rapid than those of sound. We might say that mental matter moves actually with thought. Astral matter moves so quickly after thought that the ordinary observer can scarcely note any difference. Etheric matter, of course, does not obey thought as rapidly as does astral matter. The student will of course realize that just as each particle of physical ether floats in a sea of astral matter, so each astral particle floats in a mental ocean. In spite of the idea, entertained by many people, that it is easier to deal with things on the physical plane than with those on the astral or mental planes, the reverse is the truth. For the very fineness of mental matter, and its ready response to mental impulses, makes it far easier to move, and to direct, by the action of the will, than either astral or physical matter. In the voice of the silence, three halls are spoken of: the hall of ignorance, the hall of learning, the hall of wisdom. It seems probable that the hall of ignorance stands for the physical plane, the hall of learning for the astral and lower mental planes, and the hall of wisdom for the planes of higher mind and body. On the four lower levels of the mental plane, some degree of illusion is still possible, but less it appears, for the man who can function there in full consciousness during physical life than for the undeveloped person after death, as was explained in the chapters on Devachan. The lower mental plane is thus still a region of personality and error. In it, as well as in the astral world, there is a serpent coiled under every flower, for if personal and foolish desires infest the one, pride and prejudice inhabit the other. On the higher mental plane, though there will be much that the ego does not know, what he does know he knows correctly. With the life of the causal body, however, we are not directly concerned in this volume. There is a radical difference between the lower and higher mental planes. In the lower mental, matter is dominant, it is the first thing that strikes the eye, and consciousness shines with difficulty through the forms. But in the higher planes, life is the prominent thing, and forms are there only for its purposes. The difficulty in the lower plane is to give life expression in the forms, but in the higher it is quite the reverse, to hold and give form to the flood of life. It is only above the line that divides the lower from the higher mental plane that the light of consciousness is subject to no wind, and shines with its own power. Hence the symbol of a spiritual fire is very fitting for consciousness at the higher levels, as distinguished from the lower planes, where the symbol of fire burning fuel is more appropriate. In the case of the astral plane, it is possible to give some account of its scenery, but this cannot be done for the mental plane, because the mental plane has no scenery, except such as each individual chooses to make for himself by his thought. We do not, of course, include as scenery other mental entities who are themselves in many cases objects of great beauty. The conditions of the mental plane, however, are so difficult to describe in words that it would perhaps be more accurate to say that all possible scenery exists there. There is nothing conceivable of loveliness which is not there with a fullness and intensity beyond all power of imagination. But out of this splendor of living reality each man sees only that which his development enables him to perceive. It is said to be difficult to describe the difference between the matter of the various subplanes of the mental world, because the scriber bankrupts himself of adjectives in his attempt to describe the lowest subplane, and thus has no words left for the description of the higher subplanes. All that can be said is, that as we ascend, the material becomes finer, the harmony is fuller, the light more living and transparent. There are more overtones in the sound, more delicate shades in the colors, more and new colors appear, as we rise through the subplanes. It has been said poetically, and truly, that the light of a lower plane is darkness on the one above it. On the highest subplane the matter is ensouled and vivified by an energy which flows like light from above, from the buddhic plane. As we descend through each subplane, the matter of each subplane becomes the energy of the subplane immediately below, more accurately, the original energy, plus the matter of the higher subplanes, becomes the ensouling energy of the next lower subplane. Thus the seventh or lowest subplane consists of the original energy six times enclosed or veiled, and therefore by so much, weaker and less active. The first impressions of one who enters the mental plane in full consciousness will be very much as described in chapter 20, when dealing with the man awakening, after astral death, in Devajan. He will experience intense bliss, indescribable vitality, enormously increased power, and the perfect confidence which flows from these. He finds himself in the midst of what seems to him a whole universe of ever-changing light, color and sound. He will seem to be floating in a sea of living light, surrounded by every conceivable variety of loveliness in color and form, the whole changing with every wave of thought that he sends out from his mind, and being indeed, as he will discover, only the expression of his thought in the matter of the plane and its elemental essence. Concrete thoughts, as we saw previously, take the shapes of their objects, while abstract ideas usually represent themselves by all kinds of perfect and the most beautiful geometrical forms. In this connection it should be remembered that many thoughts, which to us on the physical plane are little more than mere abstractions, are on the mental plane concrete facts. The feeling of freedom in the mental world is so great that in comparison with it astral life seems a state of bondage. Anyone who wishes to abstract himself from his surroundings on the mental plane and devote himself to quiet thought, may live in a world of his own without possibility of interruption. He will also have the additional advantage of seeing all his ideas, and their consequences, full worked out, passing before him in a sort of panorama. If, however, he wishes instead to observe the plane upon which he is, he must very carefully suspend his own thought for a time, so that he may not influence the readily impressible matter around him, cp. 114. Having attained to that condition in which he is no longer himself the center of radiation of that light, color, sound and form, it has not therefore ceased to exist. On the contrary, its harmonies and coruscations are grander than ever. Presently he will perceive that he is seeing the color language of the devas, the expression of thought or conversation of beings far higher than himself in the scale of evolution. By experiment and practice he will also find that he can himself use this mode of expression, and thus hold converse with, and learn from, these lofty non-human entities, whom we shall describe in a later chapter. For, as the student will recollect, a thought form, composed of rapidly vibrating particles of mental matter, sets up vibrations all around it, and these vibrations give rise to sensations of sound and color in any entities adapted to translate them thus. It is possible also for a visitor to the mental plane to form round himself a huge shell, through which none of the thought or conversation of other entities can penetrate, then holding his own mind perfectly still, he can examine the conditions inside his shell. He is now able to perceive another, and entirely different, series of regular pulsations, which the other more artificial phenomena had obscured. These are universal, and cannot be checked or turned aside by any shell made by human power. They produce no color or form, but flow with resistless regularity through all the matter of the plane, outwards and in again, like the exhalations and inhalations of a great breath. There are several sets of these, clearly distinguishable from one another by volume, period of vibration, and the tone of the harmony which they bring. Grander than them all sweeps one great wave which seems the very heartbeat of the system, a wave which, welling up from unknown centers on far higher planes, pours out its life through all our world, and then draws back in its tremendous tide to that from which it came. It comes in one long undulating curve, and the sound of it is like the murmur of the sea. Yet in it and through it there echoes a ringing chant of triumph, the very music of the spheres. A man who has once heard that glorious song of nature never quite loses it again. Even in the physical world, so dreary by comparison, he hears it always as a kind of undertone. If the man has reached a certain degree of spiritual development, it is possible for him to merge his consciousness with the sweep of the wave and let it bear him upward to its source. But it is not wise to do this, unless a master stands beside him to draw him back at the right moment, for otherwise its irresistible force will carry him away into still higher planes, whose far greater glories his ego is as yet unable to sustain. He will lose consciousness, with no certainty as to when and where he will regain it. Whilst the attainment of such unity is the ultimate object of man's evolution, he must reach that goal in full and perfect consciousness, and not drift into absorption in a state of blank unconsciousness but little removed from annihilation. On the mental plane a man may circle the world with the speed of thought, he is at the other side of it even as he formulates the wish to be there, for the response of mental matter to thought is immediate, and it is very readily controlled by the will. On the mental plane there is no alternation of day and night, and nothing to correspond to sleeping or waking, except of course on first entering the plane and on finally leaving it. As the physical world is three-dimensional, and the astral world four-dimensional, so is the mental world five-dimensional. But, as was explained in the astral body, p. 165, it is probably more accurate to say that consciousness on each plane is able to appreciate the world in which it is functioning in the number of dimensions given above. The three known forms of energy have their appropriate manifestations on every plane which our students have yet reached. Hence Fohat, Prana and Kundalini all exist on the mental plane, thought at present little is known of the details of their workings. A man in full consciousness on the mental plane will, of course, see the whole of humanity, excepting those who are living in their causal bodies only, for every man who is in physical or astral life must also possess a mental body. Those, however, who are confined in their own shells of thoughts in their heavens can scarcely be considered as companions, for reasons explained in the chapters on Devachan. Between those who are fully conscious on the mental plane there is far closer union than is possible at any lower level. A man can no longer deceive another with regard to what he thinks, for all mental operations lie open for everyone to see. Opinions or impressions can now be exchanged, not only with the quickness of thought, but also with perfect accuracy, for each now receives the exact idea of the other, clean, clear-cut, instantaneous, without having to puzzle his way through the maze of words. The student will recollect that on the astral plane difference of language is a barrier to communication, as thoughts must be definitely formulated in words in order to be comprehensible to another entity on that plane. On the mental plane, however, Men communicate directly by thought transference, whatever their language may be. Space is no barrier, for a man can come into touch with any other man merely by directing his attention to him. The real barrier between men are those due to the difference in their evolution. The less evolved can know only as much of the more evolved as he is able to respond to, and such limitations can obviously be felt only by the more evolved, as the lesser has all he can contain.